Okay, now you can hear me, right? Eliana, can you hear me? Okay. Welcome to Gush Base Matters. This is my world. Nylon enclosures. Nice sky, Gabi. Thanks for sharing it with us. Nice room, Eliana.
Yeah, welcome to Hillside. I'm just babysitting now, so we're taking Zach for a walk.
Let me share the source sheet. I'll try to get it out here. There we go. Okay, perfect. So, being that it's a mix, it's a Parshas Korach in America, it's Parshas Chukas in Eretz Yisrael, so I was thinking about how to bridge the two Parshas. So I said, why don't we discuss a Emida that emerges in both Parshas. And there are two Midos that are on display in both Parshas, the Mida of humility and the Mida of anger. And those are two Midos that share very special heritage, very special feature about them. The Rambam in Hilchos Deos, in Parak Aleph, describes the goal of all traits, of all human characteristics, to be what he calls the Mida Beinonis. He introduces by saying, Deos harbe yesh l'kol echad b'echad b'nei Adam. People have different viewpoints, different personalities. Line number two, yesh Adam shel bal chema, kois tamis. Some people are always very angry, always very adversarial. Some people are much more relaxed and calm and tranquil. Some people are very, very large-hearted and aspirant. We'll talk about this a bit later. And some people are much more lowly and self-effacing. Some have a lot of appetite, not just for physical pleasures, but appetites for other areas. And some are more pure-hearted. Some have wide hearts and like to spend a lot of money. Some are very, very frugal. Those are all the character traits that make up human identity. And he says in the next halacha, that's halacha aleph of parak aleph, that each of these extremes, are you always jovial, are you always quiet, you spend all your money, you're very frugal, you're very, very happy all the time, you're very sad all the time. These are two poles. And in the middle, the approach he suggests, the derech hayishara hi mido benonis. That's the middle road, the golden mean, the middle path. Now, before we continue, a lot of people misread this Rambam, as if the Rambam is a believer, is an advocate of the golden path, of the golden mean. I want to be a little bit religious, not too religious. I don't want to become fanatical. I don't want to become too passionate. I don't want to become too firm, because it'll be violating the Rambam's golden path. Now, there may be dangers with fanaticism. There may be dangers with exaggerated firm kind that isn't real and authentic. We can talk about those. That's not what the Rambam intended. The Rambam was not talking about ritual practice. He was not talking about Avodas Hashem. He was not talking about Yiras Shamayim. He was discussing character calibration. If you look at the traits that you possess as a human being and you want to sculpt the best human you can, should you be happy all the time? Should you be more serious? Middle of the road. Should you spend all your money? Should you save all your money? Middle of the road. Should you be someone that is loud or someone that's quiet? Middle of the road. So the Rambam was not describing ritual or religion. He was describing personality calibration. The Rambam writes, if you look at the screen, it is equidistant between the two poles. Okay? And that's why he writes, you always have to be balancing and calibrating and thinking. Very interesting Rambam. You shouldn't just let your personality traits evolve on pilot. You should always be measuring, thinking, calibrating, changing. Very important, especially at your age, as you're developing a personality, developing these traits, pay attention to the traits you want to develop. Pay attention to balancing the traits you want to develop. And interestingly enough, in this Parak Aleph, when the Rambam talks about calibration, he does talk about anger. He says, Ketzad, lo yeh bal chema noch lichos, shouldn't be someone with a quick temper and a quick fuse. Lo kenei, she'eno margish ela beinoni. You shouldn't be someone that's apathetic. Someone like, oh, I never want to get angry, nothing bothers me, there's no indignance, there's no fight for justice, there's no care. So you want to be somewhere in the middle. So you have a healthy response to injustice, a healthy response to problems, a healthy response to offensiveness, but also that someone's always flaring off with anger. Okay. Someone said, look, I have no desires, no interest, and I'll lead a life of asceticism and self-abnegation. No, things that are necessary for life, you should have a healthy desire for. person can say, look, I don't want to work too hard. My job is all transient. This world is all just passing. I'll be a quietist and a pacifist. No, you work with what you need to survive. Lo yikpot siyado biyose. You shouldn't be too frugal. Lo yifazer memeno. You shouldn't spend all your money. Elinosin stuck fimisis siyado. You give the amount of stuff that's appropriate. Rambam continues. Lo yei mehulo besoche. You shouldn't be constantly full of mirth and happiness and joy. Life's a beach. Life's rainbows. Lo atzeif beonin. You shouldn't be morbid and sad or morose. Ella. Balance, the Rambam says. He concludes, v'chein shar de'osav, all the other traits, you should be balanced. And the Rambam in the next halacha, which I didn't cite, calls this the derech hayashar, and he actually says that this is what HaKadosh Baruch Hu intends when he says, v'asisa hayashar v'atov. Tov is ethical, but yashar means not straight. We typically interpret the word yashar to mean straight. Yashar for the Rambam means balanced. Always make sure that it's balanced between the two extremes. Okay, this is the setting for the Rambam in Hilchos Deos Perek Beis. By the way, it's interesting that the Rambam created something called Hilchos Deos. What made the Rambam's hold of Torah so incredible was it was panoramic. Most people that study Torah are studying Torah from inside out. You learn a sugya. I learned the sugya today, very, very complex sugya, about independent Yerusha. Can a person launch independent Yerusha, divide up his nechassim in a different way? Very famous shita. And I started at the lower level. I dealt with what the Rishonim say, what the Achronim say, this deer, that Gemara, and I tried to induce. Well, from this Rishon, I can see the following definition of this halacha. And from this definition of halacha, I see the following understanding of Yerusha. This understanding of Yerusha, so I'm trying to get details and induce higher level ideas of Hashem's will. I just want to learn the details of Shas. I want to try to extract concepts from details. But people like the Rambam knew Torah so holistically, so organically, they were looking top down, like a bird would be flying over. I can't be a bird. I can work out a little detail in my landscape and then try to stand on the roof of the house that I built. But birds fly overhead and look down at the whole system. That's how well Tanayim knew Shas. Now, the way the Rambam knew Shas, he could map. He didn't have to follow the mapping. The classic mapping was Masechtos, Kiddushin, Gittin, Erevin, Shabbos, Menachos. The Rambam says, I'm not going to follow that mapping. I'm going to create a 14-sector map called Yad Chazaka. And within those 14 sectors, I'm also going to create subsectors. And that allowed the Rambam to create sections that don't naturally fit Masechtos. So there's certain sections in the Rambam that naturally fit Masechtos. Hilchos Ishos more or less fits Masechtos Kiddushin. Hilchos Gerushin more or less fits Masechtos Gittin. But then the Rambam said, let me describe one of my sections of Mada, one of the subsections of the first of the 14 will be Tshuva. There is no Masechtos. There's no Masechus in Shas, it's Tshuva. You have to collate and pick and gather clusters of ideas in different Masechus. That's how well he knew Torah. He wrote Hilchos Melachim, which describes Jewish politics. It's not really based on Sanhedrin. It's based on a lot of different ideas from Shas and others from Rambam. So Hilchos Deos, where do you get Hilchos Deos from? Which Masechta, which you look up, probably Pirkei Avos, but you need more material than Pirkei Avos can offer. So the Rambam knew Shas so well that he created his own map. And it's just when you read Hilchos Deos, it's staggering to see. I can describe it because to a degree, Rav Lichtenstein seeing new Torah that way. He would give shiurim not on a sugya, but on topics that didn't fit the sugya. So he'd give topics of Torah, and then he'd pick and choose lines of Gemara throughout Shas just to elucidate a topic. It's incredible. The last sefer that was published, he worked on it in his life, but it was published posthumously, was a sefer called Kedushas Aviv. We start to describe different forms of Kedusha, Kedushas Chafatzin, Kiddushas Makom, Kiddushas Mam, but not just conceptually, but halachically. Where do you look? Where do you start? Which Masech did he start with? If I told you to start describing the Kiddusha inherent within objects, where would you even start? I mean, I know enough Torah that I can even begin to make a map, to fill in Sefer Torah, Mezuzah, Beis HaMikdash, Korbanos, but just it's panoramic. So the Rambam is describing in Hilchos Deos, Perek Beis, that even though in general you should avoid the extremes, there are two traits where the extremes are desirable. The Yesh Deos, the Rambam writes, Sha'asur Linhog Ladan Beinonis. These two traits, you should not try to be balanced. Ela Yisrachek Min HaKatzah Echad Elekzeh Echad. You should be extreme. You should be radical. You should try to eliminate that trait entirely. You shouldn't have any part of that trait. And of course, these two traits are arrogance, who go valev, arrogance. She'ein Derech HaTov She'adam Anav Bilvad. You shouldn't just be humble in a balanced way. You should be extremely humble. And his proof, of course, is Moshe Rabbeinu. Mish Moshe Anav Mi'od. Doesn't say that he was humble. It says the word Mi'od. Mi'od means excessively. Mem Aleph Dalet. We'll talk about this later. And the other trait which the Rambam does not mention, but which I'll mention with relating to Moshe, and the rock is you should avoid anger. The chen hakas, and anger, mida rahi ad lema'od, is a terrible mida. You should be extremely, extremely aggressive in eliminating any hint of anger. These are the two traits which the Rambam mentions in Hilchos Derech's Perek Beis. Again, I just want to be clear and honest. From the Rambam in Perek Aleph, it sounds like even anger and arrogance, even those should be balanced. But in Hilchos Derech's Perek Beis, he's pretty clear that those traits should be completely, completely eliminated. So we're going to talk today about how the Rambam derived this, where did he learn this from, and how. How do you work on humility? How do you work on anger management? Okay. Yes, Eliana, let me unmute you. Yes.
I'm not quite sure.
Oh, because my computer's on. One second. I should be able to hear you now. Yes. Go ahead.
Is he not contradicting himself a little bit?
Right. So a lot of people discuss this. What's the difference between anger and arrogance in the first parak? What's there is anger in the second parak? For now, let's just assume that there's a resolution to the Rambam. I want to get to the traits themselves. But it's an important way to resolve the issue, and it may impact how to build anger and arrogance, or to build shields against them. But let's really focus on parak base. Okay? Okay, getting back to the sources. The Rambam quoted the Pasuk obviously in Balasla, where the Pasuk is defending Moshe and his integrity against Miriam and Aaron, who slandered him. Vayish Moshe Anav Miod Mikol HaAdam Asher Alpanei HaAdama. The fact that the Torah describes Moshe as Anav Miod, extremely humble, clues the Rambam off to the fact that he should be extremely humble. In fact, the Torah in Parshas Balotzcha writes about Moshe, Vayish Moshe Anav Miod. The Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, quoting Rabbi Levitas Ishiapna, we don't have that much in the name of Rabbi Levitas, he takes it one degree higher, one degree lower. Me'od, me'od, have a sheval ruach. Don't just be me'od, be me'od, me'od. Me'od, me'od, have a sheval ruach. Now, it's interesting that he adds not just anivus, but sheval ruach. We'll talk about this a little bit later, what he means by sheval ruach. But look at the difference between Parshas Balascha anav me'od and between the Mishnah and Avos, me'od, me'od, have a sheval ruach. So the common denominator is the word me'od, but the excessiveness of humility. Now, how do you build humility, right? So obviously this is a toxic trait. It's a trait which is not just dangerous in terms of its negative impact on human morality, but because it's a delicate trait, because you have to have self-esteem, and you have to have ego, and you have to have an appreciation of your talent. The easiest way to achieve humility is self-abnegation, the myth of self-denial, to enfeeble yourself rather than empower yourself, have low self-esteem, which is very, very dangerous in this world. So the source of healthy self-esteem are the communities that we live in that accept us unconditionally. The family, the community, people we feel at home, we feel safe. And unfortunately, those communities are becoming less and less functional, families and communities. That's why people's self-esteem is starting to plummet. And when people's self-esteem plummets, two things happen. One is you look for artificial fillers. Artificial fillers are how many likes are on your Facebook page. That must mean that you're an accepted person, that you're an important person, because a lot of people like, I could get a lot of likes on my Facebook page. I could curse people out. I could threaten to assassinate people. I don't know. I could get people's attention very easily. That wouldn't mean that people actually hold me in high esteem. That means people are just paying attention to things that I've done, and outlandish things would get more attention. So a substitute for healthy self-esteem is getting a lot of people to pay attention to you. It's easier to look at your Facebook feed and look in a mirror. And if a lot of people give you a thumbs up, then all of a sudden you must be an important person. That's not real self-esteem. And of course, the bigger danger of low self-esteem is not just that you'll look for it, but you'll start to abuse people in your life just to get them to like you or to obey you or to worship you. And of course, you're also victimized and vulnerable because you don't have self-esteem. You can also be a victim of abuse. A lot of people in today's world are both perpetrators as well as victims of abuse because it comes from the same root. You don't have healthy self-esteem. So how do you build humility in a real way? And instead, the Gemara says it's a mission in Avos Rav Nosson, source 5. Vayish Moshe Anav Miod, Yachol, you would think he was an Anav because he was ugly, because he was disgusting, because he was short, because he was hunchback, because he wasn't talented, because he was dysfunctional. Talmud Lomar, Vayifrosh Esa Oel, Al Mishkan. Moshe hung the curtains on the Mishkan. And the Mishkan was the Krushim were 10 amos high. Okay, I don't know, they're 30 feet high, but it's a metaphor. Moshe was tall, Moshe was handsome, Moshe was successful, Moshe was bright, Moshe was smart. So his humility wasn't built on denying his talent and denying who he was. So then how do you build real humility? So I think the two portals to real humility are as follows. First of all, you can be aware of your talent and of your successes, but if your base of comparison is other human beings, you would come away being very, very full of yourself and very satisfied and gratified and aggrandized. But if you encounter the infinity of a Kadosh Baruch Hu, then all of your accomplishments are put into perspective and put into proportion. And Moshe Rabbeinu saw Kadosh Baruch Hu so clearly. I didn't quote the pasuk in Balascha. I'll try to quote it now. Let's see if I have it here. The pasuk that right after Mishmar Moshe Anav Miod. So the pasuk describes Moshe Rabbeinu. Let me just show this for a second. Can you guys see my pasuk here? Yeah. So, Pel Pe Adaber Bo, I speak to him directly. Umarev Lo Bechidos, and he has visions that aren't through riddles. Here's the word Utmunas Hashem Yabit, and he sees the picture of Hashem. Just let that pasuk sink in for a second. What does it mean, Utmunas Hashem Yabit? We would never use that phrase about seeing Hashem's picture. What does it mean to see Hashem's picture? And even Moshe Rabbeinu in Parshas Kitisa, who wants to know Hashem, Hashem says, "Uverisa sacharai ufanei lo yero." So that's a hyperbolic statement about Moshe Rabbeinu, but that just means he was constantly in the presence of Hashem. When you're constantly in the presence of something greater than you, and that greater than you is indisputable, it puts your own self-worth or your own tendency to self-aggrandizement into check. And that's really the core of humility. So Moshe could write about himself. Moshe wrote the Torah. So if I were to write about myself that I'm humble, that'll be sanctimonious, that'll be false piety. How can I write that I'm humble? I'm claiming my own traits. Moshe Rabbeinu's humility was poised, was balanced, was honest. Said, I know what I am. I know that compared to Am Yisrael, I'm the great, or compared to any man, the greatest man that ever lived. But what are my accomplishments and the sweep of Hashem's infinity and the sweep of Hashem's eternity and the sweep of my own potential that I'll never reach? That's why really, really aspiring people are never comparing themselves to other people, because then you become self-satisfied and complacent and you'll top off certain mediocre accomplishments. But you're trying to push yourself based on your potential. Push yourself based on people greater than you. That's why it's so important to meet great people, to meet astoundingly great people. So I remember once I was invited to give a shiur in Yerushalayim, and there was a young Yerushalayim, I'll never forget, who's sitting in the front row, Ravara Lichtenstein and Tova Lichtenstein. Like, what am I going to do? What share am I going to give? I felt completely worthless, completely imbecilic, like I'm performing a magician, performing for an audience of magicians. For my next act, I'm going to pull a rabbit out of a hat. Oh, yeah, we know that one. Okay, I'm going to saw a woman in half. What am I going to say that can impress these people? So I just read what I had prepared without any theatrics, drama, rhetoric. It was all just, I wanted to finish as quickly as possible. Imagine feeling HaKadosh Baruch Hu's presence in the room at every moment. It's hard, because to be really creative, you have to turn yourself away from Hashem for a moment, because if you felt his presence overwhelming, you'd be stifled. You wouldn't think anything about yourself. You'd be completely humbled. So every time you act creatively for a moment, there's a temporary sense of self and less of a sense of Hashem. But if you have that overriding sense that Hashem is constantly in the room, you turn right back to Hashem. You say, well, Hashem, I turned away for a moment just to be creative in your Torah. I have to believe in myself a little bit, and you gave me this creativity. So I have to think about, but I'm here for you, and I'm not here to toot my own horn and to promote my own agenda. That's what I saw in Rav Lichtenstein. Rav Lichtenstein's, if you ask me his core trait, I mean, his core trait is really Avodas Hashem. But the core trait that I want to talk about today and how it translated to, he's such a humble person. And it's because you felt that he was standing in front of Kodesh Baruch Hu, Yama Valat. He really brought the Rabbanu Shalom into the room. He really personalized HaKadosh Baruch Hu and talked about Hashem as part of all of his sichot. And you got the sense that Rav Aaron knew who he was, but it didn't get to his head because he knew that Hashem had given him those traits and who's meant to be employed in the service of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The second trait, and they really blend into one another, it's the second way that you achieve real humility, is Rav Aaron was really a humanist. He really loved human beings, and he respected human beings, and showed respect for human beings, and respected their talents. And if you're a humanist, you don't feel holier than thou. You feel that you share the world with other human beings, and other human beings have talents and wisdoms, and you want to hear their talents and wisdoms. Let me tell you the following story, two stories, just to show how much he believed in humanity, and he didn't see himself as better than. He just saw himself as maybe working harder than. We once asked Rav Lichtenstein, should we be studying Bekiyas, or should we be studying Iyun? So he said, well, let's first define what Bekiyas is and what Iyun is. And he said, Bekiyas is Gemara, Rashi, Tosfos, the Rush, the Rif, Timothy Yosef, the Rambam, Tor, Shulchan Aruch. And then I was like, well, what Iyun is? So someone raised his hand and said, Rebbe, I don't understand that. It's like, if that's the way you learn Bekiyas, isn't Bekiyas intended to cover ground to finish us? You'll never finish us that way if that's your Bekiyas. And he looked at us with a straight face. There was no artifice. There was no grandeur. He just said, what do you mean? The boy asked, you'll never finish us that way. But that's your Bekiyas. And Rav Aaron said, I did. And what he meant by I did was he just worked hours and hours and hours and hours. And he just assumed that you could do it also. And the truth was, that's why he pushed you so strong morally, because he pushed you to work harder than yourself, because you had to try at least to aspire to his example. And that was really almost his fatal flaw as a teacher, because he just assumed that every 17-year-old boy that would show up in Gush would know Tanakh, Mishnayos, half a Shas, and maybe some Rambams. And many times they were far from that vision. But in that statement, I did, which is just a very simple, honest, there was a sign of respect about the human beings. You just respected people. And if you respect other people, and I've spoken with you about this in the past, that you can really draw a line in this world between two types of people. Those who respect other human beings, those who don't. You can see them the way they drive, the way they speak, the way they conduct themselves in public, the way they wear their masks. Just, are you respectful or you're not respectful? Do you show care and concern to people, or you don't show? Okay, I see you. Okay, you're walking. You're allowed to not wear your mask. It's fine. I can see you. You're walking outside. It's fine. But in Israel, you get a 500 shekel fine in 2 days. Okay, 2 days going off from 200 shekel to 500 shekel. So,
yeah, there's no laws like that in New Jersey.
Okay, I'm not a big conservative, but I want to say 500 shekel. I'm in the base medicine behind plastics. That's my thing. Another example, Eli Weber, who is a good friend of mine who runs the American Book, a very incredible person. He was a corporate lawyer for many, many years and retired to run the American program in the yeshiva. So when he turned 45, 46, happened about 10 years ago, he went to Rav Lichtenstein and he said, now that I'm past 40, you know the parts in the Ramban al-Atara segues into Kabbalah, he introduces it with a phrase, Al-Pi Ha-Emes. That's his code to say he's not going to describe now Peep Shop, but Al-Pi Kabbalah. We all skip them because we don't read Kabbalah. We don't learn Kabbalah. So Eli asked Rav Aaron, maybe now that I'm 45, maybe I should start reading those parts and not skipping them. And it's not what Rav Aaron said, but how he said it. He said, those parts in the Ramban, he said, Eli, they're not meant for people like you and me. And like, I mean, say, in what world are you and me even part of the same sentence? Like, you want to say, they're not meant for me, and Kal Vachomer, they're meant for you. Or someone of humility would have said, even I have a hard time with that, or we all have a hard time with that. And that's how he lived his life. He was aware of his accomplishments, but somehow he pulled off the sense of sharing experiences with people and not feeling. And I think it came just from love and respect for human beings. If you truly love and respect human beings, you'll see the good in people, and you'll appreciate how they change your life and how they enhance your life. And Moshe's nickname was Tov. Moshe had many nicknames. But three of the nicknames, he was Tov, Tuvia, and Chaver. Just a good friend, he was a good person. And I think that Rav Aaron's legacy to us was that as accomplished as he was, and as bright as he was, and as much as he changed the world, and he was just a good husband, and a good father, and a good friend. And just, he was just a caring, loving person. And it started a family. And so I think that those are the two traits that we see in Moshe Rabbeinu, the constant encounter with the Kadosh Baruch Hu, and the inner goodness, just to care about people and respect people. And that's typically how you build humility. I don't want to say those are the only two routes to humility, because humility is a very important trait, and everyone builds it differently. I think some people think about the frailty of the human condition in general. Certainly something like the coronavirus reminds us how frail we are and frailty. And I think having contact with frailty, I think one of the aspects of the yeshiva that Rav Aaron really began to appreciate towards the end of his life was the Darkeinu program. And just having very, very talented boys in yeshiva in the regular needs program come into contact on a daily basis with people of limited health or of limited capacity and of limited, and it created a softening to the yeshiva. And Rav Aaron really spoke about how meaningful that program was. There are great stories. Obviously, these boys were less inhibited, so the girlfriend took over Buchenstein and the dance with Buchenstein and tease him. It's just a very interesting thing to see. I think a lot of time people look to past generations and they can balance their own accomplishments based on the towering accomplishments of past generations. I recommend if any of you have an opportunity, I published an article in several Jewish syndicates. It's going to be carried this week by the Jewish Link. We'll be carrying a couple others. It'll probably be printed up in the Jerusalem Post at some point about the whole statue wars and whether we should pull down George Washington's statue or. And of course, I'm not commenting on the politics of it. I think it's a legitimate conversation. But I comment in this article on the danger of generationism, where we believe that our generation is superior to past generations. And this just feeds the fire and everything in the past. And once we're able to identify socially flawed institutions, such as slavery, that means that they were less moral and they were less. Or we look back at the Rambam's generation and maybe the undereducation of women, and the Rambam lived in those social conventions and he operated in those social conventions. So especially for religious people, it could be very dangerous because we look to the past as authoritative. We look to our past as morally compelling. It's halachically compelling. So how do you deal with, on the one hand, accepting the fact that maybe past generations had morally unjust institutions, because institutions evolve, education, race relations, economies, politics, but not necessarily cloud who they were interpersonally. Ask yourself today, are we more moral or are we less moral? In a general sense, one can say our institutions are more moral, namely the way women are treated, education, commerce, economy, politics, race. But on a personal level, are we more moral or less moral? Are we more well-behaved or less well-behaved? Are we more kind to people? And is there a relationship between the two? I have to tell you, I downgraded my Zoom account from professional Zoom account that I was paying to a less. So this is going to end in about 10 minutes. So I think the show will last a little bit longer than 10 minutes. So let's just log back on and we'll just continue. So I have a share for the boys at 5:35. So we'll end around. Oh, is that your niece or your nephew? Or just some strange baby you're kidnapping?
Yeah, I'm kidnapping him for the day.
Okay. So this is all being recorded. Amber alert. Okay. Yeah. All being recorded. Okay.
I'll make sure he goes to Gush in the future.
Obviously. Okay. Anyway, so let's get back to the shiur. So those are different ways that people build humility. And I promise you there wasn't just a Korach issue, because Moshe's humility and his humility about Aaron is on display in Korach. Remember, when these complaints first emerge about Moshe, so Moshe has his "I'm a humble person" moment. Remember, Avram's humility is expressed by Afar Ve'efer. David's humility is when he calls himself a worm, V'anochi tolas v'lo ish. In Parshas B'Shalach, where the complaints first start to erupt, so Moshe says, V'nachnu ma, ki talinu aleinu. What are we? And that's seen by, especially in the world of Chassidus, nachnu ma, you can't get any more self-abnegating than ma. There's no kanda. Nachnu ma. At least Avram's dust. At least David HaMelech's a worm. Moshe is saying, V'nachnu ma, what are we? Did I show it to you? I didn't share my screen. V'nachnu ma, what are we? So for Moshe Rabbeinu, V'nachnu ma ki talinu olav, and that's repeated in this week's Parsha, where they're complaining about Moshe and Aaron, and Moshe says, where is it here? The Aaron ma ki talinu olav. I don't talk about Moshe, I talked about Aaron. So it's a little bit about Parshas Korach. It's also a little bit related to Parshas Chukas, because in Parshas Chukas, Torah is compared to a midbar. Now, why is Torah compared to a midbar? It's also compared to Mayim. Midbar Matana, Matana Nachaliel. It's a lashon of the pasuk in Parshas Chukas. So you've got two references to Torah in that pasuk. One is midbar, two is nachal. So what do a midbar and a nachal have in common that can capture the essence of Torah? So the Gemara in Erevin talks about a midbar. I mean, midbar Matana, if a person makes himself like a midbar shah, called Dashimbo, that everyone tramples on him, then he will be zochet to learn Torah. you know, again, without getting into the potentially abusive connotations of letting people trample on you, I don't have time to fully explicate that. But it seemed by Chazal, the fact that Torah is delivered in a midbar, that humility is necessary to study Torah. It's necessary to study Torah because someone who's humble will have moral assistance from Hashem, Kosiyat and Shemaya. And true Torah study is a combination of human intellect and a Kodesh Baruch Hu helping that person. But it's also true that the less of you see in Torah, the more of a Kodesh Baruch Hu you see in Torah. The more of a Kodesh Baruch Hu you see in Torah, the more dedicated you are to understanding Torah. Torah is not just an intellectual pursuit. It's a Kodesh Baruch Hu assisting you, so Hashem will reparate people of high moral standards with Torah assistance, but also it's a moral drive. You remember information that's important to you. You remember your birthday. You remember your parents' anniversary. You remember your date of birth. You remember your social security number. You don't necessarily remember things of less importance. So ultimately, understanding Torah and retaining Torah is not just an intellectual example, it's also a moral investment. Rav Lichtenstein once told me that if you don't understand the Tosfos, which is a really, really fearsome statement, if you don't understand the Tosfos, it's not an intellectual limitation, it's a moral flaw. Because if you saw Tosfos as the most important thing you could understand, then it's true. We're just too cowardly to face that reality. It's ultimately true. If you felt that it was the word of Hashem, let's say Hashem came to you in a dream tonight and spoke to you, you'd remember every word he told you, and you'd write it down on a piece of paper and rehearse it every day of your life to remember the exact words that Hashem spoke to you in a dream directly to you. We just don't see Torah that way. We don't see Torah every word as a word of a Kodesh Baruch. We see it, but we obviously believe it, but how deeply is that belief internalized? So water is also a symbol for Torah because water starts at a very high location in the clouds. God, you see the clouds on top of you, that is that precipitation. And then it filters down and trickles down to low mountains and low valleys. And at a polar level, it starts at the polar ice caps, then it melts and descends down to the equator. So water is always in a state of descent. And Chazal say numerous times that water starts in Shemayim, it's the Bar Hashem, but it descends into the humble heart. It says, so water and Midbar share in common humility. Midbar by, it's not a rose garden that you can't trespass, you can't trample, and everyone can walk through the desert. Water starts high, it ends up in a very low location, low altitude. So it stresses the importance of humility in the acquisition of Torah. Again, I want to state this very clearly, humility is a precondition for Torah success, both morally as well as epistemologically. Namely, if you're a humble person, then morally, HaKadosh Baruch Hu will help you learn Torah. Epistemologically, the way you acquire information, you'll acquire more information of Torah if you get less of yourself, get out of your own way and see more of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So humility is a portal to Torah study, and Torah study is a facilitator of humility, because if you study Hashem's Torah, then you see Hashem, and if you see Hashem, the more of Hashem you see, the more you're protected against aggrandizement if you study Torah the real way. So it works both ways, as most of these palindromic relationships do. Humility is a gateway to Torah, both morally and epistemologically. Torah is a gateway to humility because it provides a sense of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and that sense of HaKadosh Baruch Hu is a preventative or a deterrent to arrogance. Why don't we say as follows? Why don't we log off now, not to get caught in the middle, and we'll log right back on immediately, okay? Everyone, does anyone need the link? Everyone has the link, I'm sure? Okay, everyone has the link? Okay, we'll log off, and then we'll log back, and we'll talk a little bit about anger, okay? Cool? Okay, now you can hear me, right? Eliana, can you hear me? Okay. Welcome to Gush Beis Medrash. This is my world. Nylon enclosures. Nice sky, Gabi. Thanks for sharing it with us. Nice room, Eliana.
Yeah, welcome to Hillside. I'm just babysitting now, so we're taking Zachary for a walk.
Let me share the source sheet. I'll try to get it out here. Here we go. Okay, perfect. So, being that it's a mix, it's a parshas Korach in America. It's Parshas Chukas in Eretz Yisrael. So I was thinking about how to bridge the two Parshios. So I said, why don't we discuss a midah that emerges in both Parshios? And there are two midahs that are on display in both Parshios, the midah of humility and the midah of anger. And those are two midahs that share very special heritage, very special feature about them. The Rambam in Hilchos Deos, in Parak Aleph, describes the goal of all traits, of all human characteristics, to be what he calls the Midah Beinonis. He introduces by saying, Deos harbe yesh l'kol echad v'echad m'bnei Adam, people of different viewpoints, different personalities. Line number two, yesh adam shel bal chema, kois tamis, some people are always very angry, always very adversarial. Some people are much more relaxed and calm and tranquil. Some people are very, very large-hearted and aspirant. We'll talk about this a bit later. And some people are much more lowly and self-effacing. Some have a lot of appetite, not just for physical pleasures, but appetites for other areas. And some are more pure-hearted. Some have wide hearts and like to spend a lot of money. Some are very, very frugal. Those are all the character traits that make up human identity. And he says in the next halacha, that's halacha aleph of Parak aleph, that each of these extremes, are you always jovial, you're always quiet, you spend all your money, you're very frugal, you're very, very happy all the time, you're very sad all the time. These are two poles. And in the middle, the approach he suggests, the derech hayishara hi mido benonis, that's the middle road, the golden mean, the middle path. Now, before we continue, a lot of people misread this Rambam, as if the Rambam is a believer, is an advocate of the golden path, of the golden mean. I want to be a little bit religious, not too religious. I don't want to become fanatical. I don't want to become too passionate. I don't want to become too firm, because it'll be violating the Rambam's golden path. Now, there may be dangers with fanaticism. There may be dangers with exaggerated firmkeit that isn't real and authentic. We can talk about those. That's not what the Rambam intended. The Rambam was not talking about ritual practice. He was not talking about Avodas Hashem. He was not talking about Yirat Shemayim. He was discussing character calibration. If you look at the traits that you possess as a human being and you want to sculpt the best human you can, should you be happy all the time? Should you be more serious? Middle of the road. Should you spend all your money? Should you save all your money? Middle of the road. Should you be someone that is loud or someone that's quiet? Middle of the road. So the Rambam was not describing ritual or religion. He was describing personality calibration. The Rambam writes, if you look at the screen, it is equidistant between the two poles. Okay? And that's why he writes, he always have to be balancing and calibrating and thinking. Very interesting Rambam. You shouldn't just let your personality traits evolve on pilot. You should always be measuring, thinking, calibrating, changing. Very important, especially at your age, as you're developing a personality, developing these traits, pay attention to the traits you want to develop. Pay attention to balancing the traits you want to develop. And interestingly enough, in this Parak Aleph, when the Rambam talks about calibration, he does talk about anger. He says, Ketzat, lo yeh bal chema noch lichos, shouldn't be someone with a quick temper and a quick fuse. Lo kemeh, she'eno margish ele beinoni. You shouldn't be someone that's apathetic. Someone like, oh, I never want to get angry, nothing bothers me, there's no indignance, there's no fight for justice, there's no care. So you want to be somewhere in the middle. You have a healthy response to injustice, a healthy response to problems, a healthy response to offensiveness, but also not someone who's always flaring off with anger. Okay. So we say, look, I have no desires, no interest in a legal life of asceticism and self-abnegation. No, things that are necessary for life, you should have a healthy desire for. First, you can say, look, I don't want to work too hard. My job is all transient. This world is all just passing. I'll be a quietist and a pacifist. No, you work with what you need to survive. You shouldn't be too frugal. You shouldn't spend all your money. You give the amount of stuff that's appropriate. Rambam continues. You shouldn't be constantly full of mirth and happiness and joy. Life's a beach. Life's rainbows. You shouldn't be morbid and sad and morose. balance, the Rambam says. He concludes, v'chein shar de'osav, all the other traits, you should be balanced. And the Rambam in the next halacha, which I didn't cite, calls this the derech hayashar. And he actually says that this is what HaKadosh Baruch Hu intends when he says, v'asisa hayashar v'atov. Tov is ethical, but yashar means not straight. We typically interpret the word yashar to mean straight. Yashar for the Rambam means balanced. Always make sure that it's balanced between the two extremes. Okay, this is the setting for the Rambam in Hilchos Deos Perek Beis. By the way, it's interesting that the Rambam created something called Hilchos Deos. What made the Rambam's hold of Torah so incredible was it was panoramic. Most people that study Torah are studying Torah from inside out. You learn the sugya. I learned the sugya today, very, very complex sugya, that independent Yerusha. Can a person launch independent Yerusha, divide up his nechassim in a different way? Very famous shita. And I started at the lower level. I dealt with what the Rishonim say, what the Achronim say, this Diyuk, that Gemara. And I tried to induce. Well, from this Rishon, I can see the following definition of this halacha. And from this definition of halacha, I can see the following understanding of Yerusha. This understanding of Yerusha, so I'm trying to get details and induce higher level ideas of Hashem's will. I just want to learn the details of Shas. I want to try to extract concepts from details. But people like the Rambam knew Torah so holistically, so organically, they were looking top down, like a bird would be flying over. I can't be a bird. I can work out a little detail in my landscape and then try to stand on the roof of the house that I built. But birds fly overhead and look down at the whole system. That's how well Tanayim knew Shas. Now, the way the Rambam knew Shas, he could map. He didn't have to follow the mapping. The classic mapping was Masechtos, Kiddushin, Gittin, Erevin, Shabbos, Menachos. The Rambam says, I'm not going to follow that mapping. I'm going to create a 14-sector map called Yad Chazaka. And within those 14 sectors, I'm also going to create subsectors. And that allowed the Rambam to create sections that don't naturally fit Masechtos. So there's certain sections in the Rambam that naturally fit Masechtos. Hilchos Ishus more or less fits Masechtos Kiddushin. Hilchos Gerushin more or less fits Masechtos Gittin. But then the Rambam said, let me describe one of my sections of Mada, one of the subsections of the first of the 14 will be Tshuva. There's no Masechtos in Shas, it's Tshuva. You have to collate and pick and gather clusters of ideas from different Masechtos. That's how well he knew Torah. He wrote Hilchos Melachim, which describes Jewish politics. It's not really based on Sanhedrin. It's based on a lot of different ideas from Shas and other Sfarim. So Hilchos Deos, where do you get Hilchos Deos from? Which Masechta, which you look up, probably Pirkei Avos, but you need more material than Pirkei Avos can offer. So the Rambam knew Shas so well that he created his own map. And it's just when you read Hilchos Deos, it's staggering to see. I can describe it because to a degree we're looking seeing new Torah that way. He would give shiurim not on a sugya, but on topics that didn't fit sugya. So he'd give topics of Torah, and then he'd pick and choose lines of Gemara throughout Shas just to elucidate the topic. It's incredible. The last sefer that was published, he worked on it in his life, but it was published posthumously, was a sefer called Kiddushas Aviv. We start to describe different forms of Kiddusha, Kiddushas Chafatzin, Kiddushas Makom, Kiddushas Mam, but not just conceptually, but halachically. Where do you look? Where do you start? Which Masechta did you start with? If I told you to start describing the Kiddusha inherent within objects, where would you even start? I mean, I know enough Torah that I can even begin to make a map, fill in Sefer Torah, Mezuzah, Beis HaMikdash, Korbanos, but just it's panoramic. So the Rambam is describing in Hilchos Deos, Perek Beis, that even though in general you should avoid the extremes, there are two traits where the extremes are desirable. The Yesh Deos, the Rambam writes, Sha'asur Linhog Bladan Beinonis. These two traits you should not try to be balanced. You should be extreme. You should be radical. You should try to eliminate that trait entirely. You shouldn't have any part of that trait. And of course, these two traits are arrogance. You shouldn't just be humble in a balanced way. You should be extremely humble. And his proof, of course, is Moshe Rabbeinu. Mish Moshe Anav Miod. Doesn't say that he was humble. It says the word Miod. Miod means excessively. Mem Aleph Dal. We'll talk about this later. And the other trait, which the Rambam does not mention, but which I'll mention with relating to Moshe and the rock, is you should avoid anger. The chen hakas, and anger, mida rahi ad lema'od, is a terrible mida. You should be extremely, extremely aggressive in eliminating any hint of anger. These are the two traits which the Rambam mentions in Hilchos Deos Perek Beis. Again, I just want to be clear and honest. From the Rambam in Perek Aleph, it sounds like even anger and arrogance, even those should be balanced. But if it was there as Parakabes, it's pretty clear that those traits should be completely, completely eliminated. So we're going to talk today about how the Rambam derived this, where did he learn this from, and how. How do you work on humility? How do you work on anger management? Okay. Yes, Eliana, let me unmute you. Yes.
I'm not quite sure
I can't hear you, Eliana. Oh, because my computer's on. One second. I should be able to hear you now. Yes. Go ahead.
Is he not contradicting himself a little bit?
Right. So a lot of people discuss this. What's the difference between anger and arrogance in the first paragraph? What's the difference in anger and the second paragraph? For now, let's just assume that there's a resolution to the problems. I want to get to the traits themselves. But it's an important way to resolve the issue, and it may impact how to build anger and arrogance, or to build shields against them. But let's really focus on paraphrase. Okay? Okay, getting back to the sources. The Rambam quoted the Pasuk obviously in Balasla, where the Pasuk is defending Moshe and his integrity against Miriam and Aaron, who slandered him. Vaish Moshe Anav Miod Mikol Adam Asher Al Pnei Adama. The fact that the Torah describes Moshe as Anav Miod, extremely humble, clues the Rambam off to the fact that he should be extremely humble. In fact, the Torah in Parshas Balasla writes about Moshe, Vaish Moshe Anav Miod. The Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, quoting Rabbi Levitas Ishiapna, we don't have that much in the name of Rabbi Levitas, he takes it one degree higher, one degree lower. Me'od, me'od, havei sheval ruach. Don't just be me'od, be me'od, me'od. Me'od, me'od, havei sheval ruach. Now, it's interesting that he adds not just anivus, but sheval ruach. We'll talk about this a little bit later, what he means by sheval ruach. But look at the difference between Parshas Balascha anav me'od, and between the Mishnah and Avos, mi'od, mi'od, havei sheval ruach. So the common denominator is the word mi'od, but the excessiveness of humility. Now, how do you build humility? Right. So obviously this is a toxic trait. It's a trait which is not just dangerous in terms of its negative impact on human morality, but because it's a delicate trait, because you have to have self-esteem, and you have to have ego, and you have to have an appreciation of your talent. The easiest way to achieve humility is self-abnegation, the myth of self-denial, to enfeeble yourself rather than empower yourself, have low self-esteem, which is very, very dangerous in this world. So the source of healthy self-esteem are the communities that we live in that accept us unconditionally, the family, the community, people we feel at home, we feel safe. And unfortunately, those communities are becoming less and less functional, families and communities. That's why people's self-esteem is starting to plummet. And when people's self-esteem plummets, two things happen. One is you look for artificial fillers. Artificial fillers are how many likes are on your Facebook page. That must mean that you're an accepted person, that you're an important person, because a lot of people are like, I can get a lot of likes on my Facebook page. I could curse people out. I could threaten to assassinate people. I don't know. I could get people's attention very easily. That wouldn't mean that people actually hold me in high esteem. That means people are just paying attention to things that I've done, and outlandish things would get more attention. So a substitute for healthy self-esteem is getting a lot of people to pay attention to you. It's easier to look at your Facebook feed than to look in a mirror. And if a lot of people are giving you a thumbs up, then all of a sudden you must be an important person. That's not real self-esteem. And of course, the bigger danger of low self-esteem is not just that you'll look for it, but you'll start to abuse people in your life just to get them to like you or to obey you or to worship you. And of course, you're also victimized and vulnerable because you don't have self-esteem. You can also be a victim of abuse. A lot of people in today's world are both perpetrators as well as victims of abuse because it comes from the same root. You don't have healthy self-esteem. So how do you build humility in a real way? And saying that the Gemara says it's a mission in Avisher of Nelson, source 5. Vaish Moshe Anav Miod. Yachol, you would think he was an Anav because he was ugly, because he was disgusting, because he was short, because he was hunchback, because he wasn't talented, because he was dysfunctional. Moshe hung the curtains on the Mishkan. And the Mishkan was, the Kroshim were 10 amos high. Okay, I don't know, they're 30 feet high, but it's a metaphor. Moshe was tall, Moshe was handsome, Moshe was successful, Moshe was bright, Moshe was smart. So his humility wasn't built on denying his talent and denying who he was. So then how do you build real humility? So I think the two portals to real humility are as follows. First of all, you can be aware of your talent and of your successes, But if your base of comparison is other human beings, you would come away being very, very full of yourself and very satisfied and gratified and aggrandized. But if you encounter the infinity of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, then all of your accomplishments are put into perspective and put into proportion. And Moshe Rabbeinu saw HaKadosh Baruch Hu so clearly. I didn't quote the pasuk in Balascha. I'll try to quote it now. Let's see if I have it here. The pasuk that right after Mish Moshe Anav Miod, so the pasuk describes Moshe Rabbeinu. Let me just show this for a second. Can you guys see my pasuk here? Yeah. So, Pel Pel Daber Bo, I speak to him directly. Umarev Lo Bechidos, and he has visions that aren't through riddles. Here's the word Utmunas Hashem Yabit, and he sees the picture of Hashem. Just let that pasuk sink in for a second. What does it mean, Tmunas Hashem Yabit? We would never use that phrase about seeing Hashem's picture. What does it mean to see Hashem's picture? And even Moshe Rabbeinu in Parshas Kitisa, who wants to know Hashem, Hashem says, Uverisa Sacharai Ufanai Lo Yero. So that's a hyperbolic statement about Moshe Rabbeinu, but that just means he was constantly in the presence of Hashem. When you're constantly in the presence of something greater than you, and that greater than you is indisputable, it puts your own self-worth or your own tendency to self-aggrandizement into check. And that's really the core of humility. So Moshe could write about himself, Ish Moshe Anamir. Moshe wrote the Torah. So if I were to write about myself that I'm humble, that would be sanctimonious, that would be false piety. How can I write that I'm humble? I'm claiming my own traits. Moshe Rabbeinu's humility was poised, was balanced, was honest, said, I know what I am. I know that compared to Am Yisrael, I'm the great, or compared to any man, the greatest man that ever lived. But what are my accomplishments and the sweep of Hashem's infinity and the sweep of Hashem's eternity and the sweep of my own potential that I'll never reach? That's why really, really aspiring people are never comparing themselves to other people, because then you become self-satisfied and complacent and you'll top off certain mediocre accomplishments. But you're trying to push yourself based on your potential, push yourself based on people greater than you. That's why it's so important to meet great people, to meet astoundingly great people. I remember once I was invited to give a shiur in Yerushalayim, and it was for Yom Yerushalayim, I'll never forget, who's sitting in the front row, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein and Tova Lichtenstein. Like, what am I going to do? What shiur am I going to give? I felt completely worthless, completely imbecilic, like I'm performing, a magician performing for an audience of magicians. For my next act, I'm going to pull a rabbit out of a hat. Oh, yeah, we know that one. Okay, I'm going to saw a woman in half. What am I going to say that can impress these people? So I just read what I had prepared without any theatrics, drama, rhetoric. It was all just, I wanted to finish as quickly as possible. Imagine feeling HaKadosh Baruch Hu's presence in the room at every moment. It's hard, because to be really creative, you have to turn yourself away from Hashem for a moment. Because if you felt His presence overwhelming, you'd be stifled. You wouldn't think anything about yourself. You'd be completely humbled. So every time you act creatively for a moment, there's a temporary sense of self and less of a sense of Hashem. But if you have that overriding sense that Hashem is constantly in the room, you turn right back to Hashem. You say, well, Hashem, I turned away for a moment just to be creative in your Torah. I had to believe in myself a little bit, and you gave me this creativity. So I have to think about, but I'm here for you, and I'm not here to toot my own horn and to promote my own agenda. That's what I saw in Rav Lichtenstein. Rav Lichtenstein's, if you ask me his core trait, I mean, his core trait is really Avodas Hashem. But the core trait that I want to talk about today and how it translated to, he's such a humble person. And it's because you felt that he was standing in front of Kodesh Baruch Hu, Yom HaVelat. He really brought the Ribbono Shel Olam into the room. He really personalized HaKadosh Baruch Hu and talked about Hashem as part of all of his sichot. And you got the sense that Rav Aaron knew who he was, but it didn't get to his head because he knew that Hashem had given him those traits and was meant to be employed in the service of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The second trait, and they really bled into one another, it's the second way that you achieve real humility, is Rav Aaron was really a humanist. He really loved human beings, and he respected human beings, and he showed respect for human beings, and respected their talents. And if you're a humanist, you don't feel holier than thou. You feel that you share the world with other human beings, and other human beings have talents and wisdoms, and you want to hear their talents and wisdoms. Let me tell you the following story. These two stories just to show how much he believed in humanity, and he didn't see himself as better than. He just saw himself as maybe working harder than. We once asked Rav Lichtenstein, should we be studying Bekiyas or should we be studying Iyun? So he said, well, let's first define what Bekiyas is and what Iyun is. And he said, Bekiyas is Gemara Rashi, Tosfos, the Rush, the Rif, Timothy Yosef, the Rambam, Tur, Shulchan Aruch. And then I was like, well, what Ian is? So someone raised his hand and said, Rebbe, I don't understand that. So like, if that's the way you learn Bikiyas, isn't Bikiyas intended to cover ground to finish us? You'll never finish us that way if that's your Bikiyas. And he looked at us with a straight face. There was no artifice. There was no grandeur. He just said, what do you mean? The boy asked, you'll never finish us that way. That's your Bikiyas. And Ravaran said, I did. And what he meant by I did was he just worked hours and hours and hours and hours. And he just assumed that you could do it also. And the truth was, that's why he pushed you so strong morally, because he pushed you to work harder than yourself, because you had to try at least to aspire to his example. And that was really almost his fatal flaw as a teacher, because he just assumed that every 17-year-old boy that would show up in Gush would know Tanakh, Mishnayos, half a Shas, and maybe some Rambams. And many times they were far from that vision. But in that statement, I did, which just a very simple, honest, there was a sign of respect about the human beings. You just respected people. And if you respect other people, and I've spoken with you about this in the past, that you can really draw a line in this world between two types of people. Those who respect other human beings, those who don't. You've seen it in the way they drive, the way they speak, the way they conduct themselves in public, the way they wear their masks. Just, are you respectful or are you not respectful? Do you show care and concern to people or you don't show? Okay, I see you. Okay, if you're walking, you're allowed to not wear your mask. It's fine. I can see you. You're walking outside. It's fine. But in Israel, you get a 500 shekel fine in 2 days. Okay, in 2 days going off from 200 shekel to 500 shekel. So,
yeah, there's no laws like that in New Jersey.
Okay, I'm gonna be conservative, but I want to say 500 shekel. I'm in the base medicine behind plastics. So that's my another example. Ellie Weber, who's a good friend of mine who runs the American Broken, very incredible person. He was a corporate lawyer for many, many years and retired to run the American Broken in the yeshiva. So when he turned 45, 46, happened about 10 years ago, he went for a blitzin and he said, now that I'm past 40, you know the parts in the Ramban al-Atara segues into Kabbalah. He introduces it with a phrase, Alpiha MS. That's his code to say he's now going to describe. Now, Peep Shop, but Alpi Kabbalah. We all skip them because we don't read Kabbalah. We don't learn Kabbalah. So Ellie asked Ravaran, maybe now that I'm 45, maybe I should start reading those parts and not skipping them. And it's not what Ravaran said, but how he said it. He said, those parts in the Ramban, he said, Ellie, they're not meant for people like you and me. And like Ellie was saying, in what world are you and me even part of the same sentence? Like, you want to say, they're not meant for me, and Kal Vachomer, they're not meant for you. Or someone of humility would have said, even I have a hard time with that, or we all have a hard time with that. Just, and that's how he lived his life. He was aware of his accomplishments, but somehow he pulled off the sense of sharing experiences with people and not feeling. And I think it came just from love and respect for human beings. If you truly love and respect human beings, you'll see the good in people and you'll appreciate how they change your life and how they enhance your life. And Moshe's nickname was Tov. Moshe had many nicknames, but three of the nicknames, he was Tov, Tuvia, and Chaver. Just a good friend, he was a good person. And I think that Ravaran's legacy to us was that as accomplished as he was and as bright as he was and as much as he changed the world and the lit, he was just a good husband and a good father and a good friend, and just he was just a caring, loving person. And it started a family and so I think that those are the two traits that we see in Moshe Rabbeinu: the constant encounter with the Kadosh Baruch Hu and the inner goodness just to care about people and respect people. And that's typically how you build humility. I don't want to say those are the only two routes to humility, because humility is a very important trait and everyone builds it differently. I think some people think about the frailty of the human condition in general. Certainly something like the coronavirus reminds us how frail we are and frailty. And I think having contact with frailty, I think one of the aspects of the yeshiva that Ravaran really began to appreciate towards the end of his life was the Darkeinu program. And just having very, very talented boys in yeshiva in the regular needs program come into contact on a daily basis with people of limited health or of limited capacity and of limited, and it's just, it created a softening to the yeshiva and everyone really spoke about how meaningful that program was. There are great stories. Obviously, these boys were less inhibited, so the girlfriend took over the booking scene and the dancer was looking at and teased him. It's just a very interesting thing to see. I think a lot of time people look to past generations and they can balance their own accomplishments based on the towering accomplishments of past generations. I recommend if any of you have an opportunity, I published an article in several Jewish syndicates. It's going to be carried this week by the Jewish Link. We'll be carrying a couple others. It'll probably be printed up in the Jerusalem Post at some point about the whole statue wars and whether we should pull down George Washington's statue or. And of course, I'm not commenting on the politics of it because I think it's a legitimate conversation. But I comment in this article on the danger of generationism, where we believe that our generation is superior to past generations. And this just feeds the fire and everything in the past. And once we're able to identify socially flawed institutions such as slavery, that means that they were less moral and they were less. And, or we look back at the Rambam's generation and maybe the undereducation of women, and the Rambam lived in those social conventions and he operated in those social conventions. So especially for religious people, it could be very dangerous because we look to the past as authoritative. We look to our past as morally compelling. It's halachically compelling. So how do you deal with, on the one hand, accepting the fact that maybe past generations had morally unjust institutions because institutions evolved, education, race relations, economies, politics, but not necessarily cloud who they were interpersonally. Like, ask yourself today, are we more moral or are we less moral? In a general sense, one can say our institutions are more moral, namely the way women are treated, education, commerce, economy, politics, race. But on a personal level, are we more moral or less moral? Are we more well-behaved or less well-behaved? Are we more kind to people? And is there a relationship between the two? I have to tell you, I downgraded my Zoom account from professional Zoom account that I was paying to a less. So this is going to end in about 10 minutes. So I think the show will last a little bit longer than 10 minutes. So let's just log back on and we'll just continue. I have a share for the boys at 5:35, so I'll end around. Oh, is that your niece or your nephew, Gabby? Or just some strange baby you're kidnapping?
Yeah, I'm kidnapping him for the day.
Okay, so this is all being recorded. Amber Alert. Okay. Yeah. All being recorded. Okay.
I'll make sure he goes to Gush in the future.
Okay. Anyway, so let's get back to the shiur. So those are different ways that people build humility. And I promise you there wasn't just a Korach issue because Moshe's humility and his humility about Aaron is on display in Korach. Remember, when these complaints first emerge about Moshe, so Moshe has his "I'm a humble person" moment. Remember, Avram's humble humility is expressed by Afar Veifer. David's humility is when he calls himself a worm, V'anochi tolas v'lo ish. In Parshas B'Shalach, where the complaints first start to erupt, so Moshe says, V'nachnu ma ki talinu aleinu. What are we? And that's seen by, especially in the world of Chassidus, Nachnu ma, you can't get any more self-abnegating than ma. There's no kanda. Nachnu ma. At least Avram's dust. At least David HaMelech's a worm. Moshe is saying, V'nachnu ma, what are we? Oh, did I show it to you? I didn't share my screen. V'nachnu ma, what are we? So for David, for Moshe Rabbeinu, V'nachnu ma ki talinu olav, and that's repeated in this week's Parsha, where they're complaining about Moshe and Aaron, and Moshe says, where is it here? The Aaron ma ki talinu olav. I don't talk about Moshe, I talked about Aaron. So it's a little bit about Parshas Korach. It's also a little bit related to Parshas Chukas, because in Parshas Chukas, Torah is compared to a midbar. Now, why is Torah compared to a midbar? It's also compared to Miami. Midbar Matana, Matana Nachaliel. It's the lashon of the pasuk in Parshas Chukas. So you've got two references to Torah in that pasuk. One is mi midbar, two is Nachal. So what do a midbar and a Nachal have in common that can capture the essence of Torah? So the Gemara in Erevin talks about a midbar. When we midbar Matana, if a person makes himself like a midbar, shakol dashimbo, that if one tramples on him, then he will be zochet to learn Torah. Now, again, without getting into the potentially abusive connotations of letting people trample on you, I don't have time to fully explicate that. But it's seen by Chazal, the fact that Torah is delivered in a midbar, that humility is necessary to study Torah. It's necessary to study Torah because someone who's humble will have moral assistance from Hashem, Kosiyat and Shemaya. And true Torah study is a combination of human intellect and a Kodesh Baruch Hu helping that person. But it's also true that the less of you you see in Torah, the more of HaKadosh Baruch Hu you see in Torah. The more of HaKadosh Baruch Hu you see in Torah, the more dedicated you are to understanding Torah. Torah is not just an intellectual pursuit. It's HaKadosh Baruch Hu assisting you. So Hashem will reparate people of high moral standards with Torah assistance. But also, it's a moral drive. You remember information that's important to you. You remember your birthday. You remember your parents' anniversary. You remember your date of birth. You remember your social security number. You don't necessarily remember things of less importance. So ultimately, understanding Torah and retaining Torah is not just an intellectual example, it's also a moral investment. Rav Lichtenstein once told me that if you don't understand the Tosfos, which is a really, really fearsome statement, if you don't understand the Tosfos, it's not an intellectual limitation, it's a moral flaw. Because if you saw Tosfos as the most important thing you can understand, then it's true. We're just too cowardly to face that reality. It's ultimately true. If you felt that it was the word of Hashem, let's say Hashem came to you in a dream tonight and spoke to you, you'd remember every word he told you, and you'd write it down on a piece of paper and rehearse it every day of your life to remember the exact words that Hashem spoke to you in a dream directly to you. We just don't see Torah that way. We don't see Torah every word as the word of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We see it, but we obviously believe it, but how deeply is that belief internalized? So water is also a symbol for Torah because water starts at a very high location in the clouds. God, you see the clouds on top of you, that is that precipitation. And then it filters down and trickles down to low mountains and low valleys. And at a polar level, it starts at the polar ice caps, then it melts and descends down to the equator. So water is always in a state of descent. And Chazal say numerous times that water starts in Shemayim, it's the Bar Hashem, but it descends into the humble heart. So water and Midbar share in common humility. Midbar by, it's not a rose garden that you can't trespass, you can't trample, and everyone can walk through the desert. Water starts high, it ends up in a very low location, low altitude. So it stresses the importance of humility in the acquisition of Torah. Again, I want to state this very clearly, humility is a precondition for Torah success, both morally as well as epistemologically. Namely, if you're a humble person, then morally, HaKadosh Baruch Hu will help you learn Torah. Epistemologically, the way you acquire information, you'll acquire more information of Torah if you get less of yourself, get out of your own way, and see more of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So humility is a portal to Torah study, and Torah study is a facilitator of humility. Because if you study Hashem's Torah, then you see Hashem, and if you see Hashem, the more Hashem you see, the more you're protected against aggrandizement if you study Torah the real way. So it works both ways, as most of these palindromic relationships do. The humility is a gateway to Torah, both morally and epistemologically. Torah is a gateway to humility because it provides a sense of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and that sense of HaKadosh Baruch Hu is a preventative or a deterrent to arrogance. Why don't we say as follows? Why don't we log off now not to get caught in the middle, and we'll log right back on immediately, okay? Everyone, does anyone need the link? Everyone has the link, I'm sure? Okay, everyone has the link? Okay, we'll log off, and then we'll log back, and we'll talk a little bit about anger, okay? Cool? Okay.